The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested indirectly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Saulnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition, as this show is probably going to be released approximately June 12th or so. On this Q&A show, we are going to answer hopefully four questions. We've got a question on dollar cost averaging, a question on funding a special needs trust, question on RMDs from an inherited IRA, and then also a question on charitable remainder trusts. So quite a variety of questions today. Today's show is going to sound a little bit different because Jim has decided to hang out at home on his lounger chair and eat bonbons while he's doing the show. So he's calling in remotely. So if you notice that his voice sounds a little different than normal, that's why. Jim, Are you with us?
I am here, but you're making it sound like I'm playing hooky, which I guess technically I am, trying to take Fridays off. But this is a unique week because next week I won't be in the office at all. So you will be doing the Q&A show next week by yourself, a bunch of Social Security questions. I think we have six or seven. And then there may be an EDU show next week as well with you and Tax Joe. Talking about taxation of Social Security. And I will be in Vegas. You know, I checked the weather for Vegas next week. You know how the coolest day is going to be that I'm there? You know what the coolest day is going to be?
I don't know, probably 92.
97.
Oh, nice. I'll enjoy that.
The hottest day is going to be 106.
Oh.
It's only June.
Wow.
Who the hell could live there? I mean, that's just insane. But,
But it's a dry heat.
Yeah, so is my oven, but I don't sit in it. But my goodness, it's freaking hot. I was wondering what to wear. I was thinking of bringing sports coats. You can't wear sports coats in that weather. But anyways, next week I will be at the AICPA meeting, which is the Association of International Certified Professional Accountants. I will be attending 3 days of training on advanced estate planning and advanced financial planning. Sounds like everybody wishes they could probably be there, huh?
Well, the good news is it should be indoors, so the heat won't bother you so much.
Yes, it's at the MGM Grand. We will be there.
Very nice. I'll enjoy
that. I thought so. But anyways, that's one of the reasons I'm working from home, and I took time out of putzing around in my garden. I got my carrots planted today, my summer squashes, and working on getting a few other things growing. But took a break and decided to call you and record the Q&A show. So before we begin, though, and this is a I'm throwing this out there in left field. I didn't tell you I was going to do this. Yeah, you better because you, my friend, owe me an apology. And I'll let you apologize. It's okay. I'll let you apologize when I'm done. The one thing I want to explain is new listeners, don't give us a bad review on iTunes that we go on with bantering sometimes. Just keep hitting the advanced button until I stop. Longtime listeners, Chris owes me an apology, and you will know what I'm talking about.
Okay.
Yes. So you know how you know how I occasionally mispronounce words, and
really?
Yes, and have my own way. What do you call it? Where I conflate two sayings into my own saying.
I call them Jimisms, but
Jimisms. Yeah. Yes. Mm-hmm. And you have quite a collection of Jimisms.
For a while, I was recording them because I thought it would be a finite list, but apparently it just grows and grows every year, so I kind of gave up on keeping track.
It's too bad you haven't kept them. That would have been a nice little best of recording.
I might find that old document some point, yeah.
All Jimisms.
So you found someone who speaks like you do, and now I owe you an apology?
You do, because there is one Jimism that I keep insisting is not a Jimism.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to set the stage here. This came from a man who, I don't know this guy. It was posted on the FPA form, which is one of the forms on financial planning that I track online.
Yeah.
I mean, it's long. This guy's smart. He must have wrote a couple of thousand words. This thing is really, really long. And I don't want to get into what he's posting on. I think you know the FPA is kind of in a little bit of turmoil. They're trying to change, and some people are mad, some people aren't. You know that whole thing going on.
Yeah.
So he's giving his opinion. That's all. I just want to set the stage. He's giving his opinion of FPA's changes.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes, and again, this is from a smart man. There's a lot of words in his post. So he writes, "My largest complaint was the communication of the plan and the characterization of it as something we were asking for and were aware of. But at this point, we've beaten this horse to death, and I offer nothing new to say. Do you want to apologize now or later?"
No. Just because he used a lot of words doesn't mean he's the authority on sayings that have become entrenched in our American psyche.
We
don't beat a dead horse. We don't beat the horse to death. No.
And I want to point out, this was posted on April 18th.
Mm-hmm.
There is absolutely no one posting a correction to him. No one is picking on him. No one is laughing at him. No one is writing that down and chastising him later.
Well, I'll go in and do that then. Because I have access to that forum, too. Well, with so many words, it probably got lost. It got lost in the ocean of words that he put out there.
I want to also point out, we had the New Jersey listener who wrote to us and said in Jersey they use it.
They beat horses to death?
Yes, remember? They wrote as a question and defended, beat this horse to death. And then there was someone else from another state. I want to say North Carolina, but I'm not sure, who also supported the use of beat the horse to death. Now we have another man who I'm not going to name, but writing a post from April 18th.
This sounds like something that should be reported to PETA. And not Peter Scott. People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. That Peter.
Well, anyways, I'm not going to beat this horse to death and keep going on and on over it, but this is indisputable proof.
I don't know. That's pretty demanding an apology because of one person out there who happens to put it in writing. Okay, so there's three people. You know how many people are in the United States? 380 million people. Just because three of them happen to have the same defect as you.
On that one.
Okay. Okay, maybe we should have a new poll. We'll put up a new poll about that and see which one people accept. We'll see. Okay, we'll do this more scientifically. So anyway,
I want to point out, this guy doesn't know us. He probably doesn't listen to the podcast. And there he is using the verbiage, "I've beaten this horse to death."
Okay.
"We've beaten this horse to death."
So on to dollar cost averaging.
So let's get on, because we probably lost a bunch of listeners who are all overly angry now. Okay, so you want to do the dollar cost averaging question first? Yeah. Let me find it.
Perfect.
Okay. This is from a listener in... No idea, he doesn't say. So, no idea. Okay, he begins, "Hello, first, I want to thank you for a wonderful podcast. I enjoy learning from it a great deal. My question is relating to doing a direct rollover from my company's 401k into an outside investment house, maybe Vanguard. When the transfer takes place, a large amount of cash is going to be deposited, which is into a money market fund, and will wait there until I decide what to do with it. My question is, let's say I want to use 60% of it to buy an S&P 500 index fund. That is a large amount of money. Should I do it all at once? What if on that day the market shoots up? Then my life savings would take... Shoots up? Why would it take a loss? Then my life savings would take a loss because it would buy fewer shares. I see what he's saying. It is funny that in all your working life, they advise you to do dollar cost averaging and buy small, regular amounts over time to average out market fluctuations. Then when you retire, you risk all of your savings with one shot by buying into the market regardless of if it's up or down on that particular day. Is this how people really do an IRA rollover? Thanks in advance." And he gave his initials.
Well, first let me say most people don't do it that way because they don't liquidate to cash to do the rollover. So, I mean, it depends on if the investments that are in there are available outside of the 401k, which must be the case in his situation, that he's being forced to have this big amount of cash that rolls out. But
right. I will say some 401ks, Chris, will distribute assets. Some will distribute only cash. Mm-hmm. Then you also have to deal with the receiving custodian. In other words, the place where he's going to hold the IRA. Perhaps the investments inside his 401k are proprietary and only available there. Maybe they're not even mutual funds, and instead they're separately managed accounts, which are very common in 401ks. And they're managed specifically for large 401ks, usually by money managers. Those are not available. You can't transfer them out. But I agree with you. If he's in a small to mid-sized 401k, he probably has investment funds inside there that would also be available outside of the account. So he could ask Vanguard, if he's going to move to Vanguard first, he can ask them, "Can you hold these funds?" But at the same time, ask the 401k, "Can you distribute the shares, or are you only going to distribute cash?"
Right.
But here's my point. Let's play devil's advocate for him, Chris.
Yep.
Let's pretend they can only transfer cash.
Right. Yep.
He's fully invested on Monday. Tuesday, they sell. Wednesday or Thursday, they transfer cash. It gets to Vanguard a day or two later, so it's the following Monday. And now he's afraid to buy because he says, "I'm in cash and I'm putting this large amount to work." I don't understand his logic. He was fully invested the week before.
If he was. Now, if he's been sitting on cash for some reason, cash equivalents in his 401k, that's a different story. And he's intentionally choosing at that point then to be timing the market. And that's what you're trying to avoid with dollar cost averaging, is making conscious timing decisions. It kind of all smooths out. But I agree with you. If he takes it out, if the market hasn't done anything crazy in those few days during this transaction, just put it back in the market. Just invest it again. It's going to be as if you had just held it through that period anyway. Now, if there is a huge drop, oh my gosh, you were just blessed with the ability to buy on a dip. If it goes way up, that is unfortunate. But you know, you'd have to then sit back and decide if that's a more long-lasting surge forward or if it's temporary. Then you're asking yourself market timing questions, which can get a little bit tricky. And you know, a person may or may not be feel comfortable doing that or even equipped to make that kind of analysis. People even who think they're equipped to make that kind of analysis probably are overestimating their analytical abilities, to be honest with you. But
right. And I will say we have people who are moving 401ks all the time, mm-hmm. in or out of an IRA, or money all the time into or out of an IRA. Some people specifically hold cash and say, hey, this mm-hmm. is for me to buy and take advantage when the market's going down because they're no longer adding money to that account. They're not working anymore. They want to build up. It's called a reserve. We have many people who do that. But we have just as many people who don't do that and will just fully invest right away. What this man needs to, or woman, I'm not really sure if it's man or woman, what this person needs to consider is the time frame of that money. If the market was to fall, I often say, you know, everybody hears the saying, if a tree falls in a forest and if no one's there, does it make a sound? I kind of turn that around on investing. If your portfolio falls 20%, but you don't need to sell it, does it really matter? So he's overanalyzing a lot if there's this big market drop and he's worried about that, or he's worried about missing out if there's a major market rally. Well, when does he need that money? If that money is, again, earmarked, say, what we call bucket three or crazy uncle, we nickname it. If this is your money that you're going to need 10, 15, 18 years from now, just invest it and be done with it. If it's money, he's retiring, so if it's money that he's going to need earlier, he may not want to fully invest it. And maybe the 60% that he wants to put in an S&P 500 index fund is appropriate because it's being earmarked towards his bucket three, and the other 40% is going to be held in cash, and that's what he's going to spend for the next 10 years or so. So don't overanalyze in that case what your investment pool does the day after you invest it. Does it really matter? No.
Right.
But if you need that money right away, yes, a major drop right after you invest it would hurt. That's why you don't invest money that you're going to need in a year or two or three or four even.
And I agree that takes more focus. That he needs to focus more on that question than, is today the right day to do it? It's more,
exactly.
You know,
exactly.
If I need this money in the short term, I might need to rethink where I'm putting it, not the day I'm putting it in there.
Exactly. And if he is fully invested now, and the old, and if that's appropriate, let's just say it's totally appropriate for him. He's, even though he's retiring now, he doesn't need that money for another 10, 12, 15, 18 years. So it's a long-term investment, but they will not transfer shares. He has to transfer cash. Don't worry about it. Just transfer it, and as soon as it gets to the IRA, invest it. Who cares if you were out of the market for a few days and you might have got the shares a little bit cheaper, or maybe they've gone down in price and you're buying a few more shares than you would have. Who cares? Just get it in. But if it's money you're going to need to start spending from, start bucketing that, start positioning it more for spending, and the money that's going to be invested long term, you again, and this comes to a person's personal belief. We have people we're working with right now who hold a lot of money in reserve and are waiting for a market correction, and other people who despise any type of reserve, any type of money market holding at all. They want to be fully invested at all times. But that should only be done with his longer-term money. His shorter-term money, he may want to use that money market or other types of less risky holdings. Does that make sense?
Totally.
Perfect. Okay. So that one's done. Let's do this one. This one is funding a charitable remainder trust. Okay. It begins, Dear Jim and Chris, I listened to your podcast on inherited IRAs, willed to a trust, and the one on required minimum distributions. You taught me all the problems, well, I don't know if we taught all of them, all the problems that could be created with regard to large tax liabilities if stretch RMDs are not granted. And if I can put a little commercial note in here, stretch IRA is going the way of the dodo bird if the bills working their way through the House and the Senate do pass.
Yep.
And why don't you just briefly explain what the stretch is, Chris, in case this is a new listener and have no idea what we're talking about.
So the stretch is where, under certain circumstances, a non-spouse beneficiary, so you're handing your IRA or other qualified account off to someone other than your spouse, they, if they follow the rules, have the ability to stretch out the distributions of those funds over their remaining expected lifespan instead of taking it in a short period of time and possibly causing them much higher tax burden and tax consequences. So because we're stretching it out over a long period of time, that's why we call it a stretch IRA. And in current law, you're allowed to do that in the right circumstances, but that is under attack. The stretch IRA hasn't always existed, and it looks like we're headed back to the old rule or some variation of the old rule where they're going to force you to take money out much faster.
Exactly. And that used to be called the five-year rule, right? Because a non-spouse beneficiary had to close an IRA within 5 years. The House is going to bring back what they call a 10-year rule, and the Senate is sticking with the 5-year rule, but not if the IRA is worth less than $450,000. I have no idea what version is going to pass, but the stretch is going away. And that was his question, Chris. He says, my question is in regard to the large tax liabilities if stretch RMDs are not granted to our disabled son's trust, or if stretch IRAs are rescinded entirely by Congress. I'm 74 years old and have IRAs worth over $1 million. I'm worried that our son, or more accurately the trust, his son has special needs and he created a special needs trust, will not have enough money available because of the high taxes the trust will pay. And what he's talking about there is when the money comes from his IRA. Remember, listeners, we say all the time on this podcast, when it comes to what the industry calls qualified money, or what Chris and I term always taxable money, or always taxable accounts, such as IRAs, 401ks, 403bs, 457s, when it comes to those accounts, you may see assets. The IRS sees income, and every dollar coming out of those accounts are taxed as income. With a special needs trust, you cannot pass all the money on to the recipient of that special needs trust, or that recipient can lose some or all of their government benefits. So a special needs trust is what the industry calls a discretionary trust. It allows the trustee of the trust to hold money paid in, and it's the trustee's discretion and the ability of that trustee to direct payments to certain expenses only and not all expenses that allow the recipient of that money, who is disabled, to still receive government benefits. The problem is the taxation of income with trusts. What's the problem with that, Chris?
Well, trusts experience the highest marginal tax rates in the tax code at very low income levels. And I don't have the exact number, but
$12,500.
Yeah, it's less than $15,000, so $12,500. Any income recognized by the trust above that amount is taxed at the highest marginal tax rate, where an individual would have to be making lots of money, hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars, in order to be in the highest tax bracket. So they have a very, very unattractive tax treatment as income is recognized in the trust.
And remember, folks, even if the IRA, which is allowed to distribute assets, unlike the 401k we mentioned in the previous question, even if the IRA distributes assets, actual investments, mutual funds, ETFs, whatever the case may be, into the special needs trust, the special needs trust has still got to declare it as income.
Yep.
It is not an asset. Even though a mutual fund share may transfer in, it's still considered income. And the trust will pay income taxes on all income received in any given year and not distributed to the beneficiary. So if $1 million transfers in and he's worried about the five-year rule coming back, if the five-year rule does come back, $200,000 a year is going to come out of his million-dollar IRA into the special needs trust. It's if it's held, and it's going to have to be, you can't pass $200,000 onto the special needs recipient. They would lose all governmental assistance. So it sits in the trust, and the $200,000 would be subject as income to income taxes, and anything above $12,500 will be taxed at 37%, plus any state and local income taxes that may also apply depending on where he lives. And he lives in Connecticut. Connecticut is a high-tax state. Yeah,
so he's probably looking at losing half.
I saw Connecticut.
Half of that IRA that gets distributed as income into the trust each year will go away in taxes.
And that's what he writes. He's worried his son now may not have enough money because of the taxes. So, to continue with his question, I'm worried that our son, or more accurately the trust, will not have enough money available because of the high tax rates that will be assigned to trusts and the possibility that the five-year rule is imposed. I have thought of a strategy that may mitigate some of the tax damage and would like your opinion. One of my IRAs is at TIAA. In their traditional account, there's about $250,000. It stipulates only 10% can be withdrawn a year. You and I are very familiar with that account, Chris.
Yeah.
It is a fixed account yielding almost 4% a year. I currently withdraw just the interest, and that satisfies my RMDs for that account. Oh, wait a minute. He writes, I currently withdraw just the interest, and I meet the RMD requirements for all my IRAs combined. I do want to ask that listener, this has nothing to do with his general question, please make sure the TIA traditional account is in fact an IRA. I've always seen them as 403Bs. And that when it moves into the IRA, it is no longer the traditional account and subject to the 10% per year limitations. I've only seen that 10% per year limitation on 403Bs. If you have a 403B, that distribution cannot be used to offset your IRA RMDs. Because what he wrote, Chris, is that the money coming from that account, the interest, almost 4% on $250,000, is enough money to cover all his RMDs. That only applies if it's IRAs. 403Bs cannot offset RMDs from an IRA. And I have only seen this TIA traditional in a 403B. That is not to say they don't exist inside an IRA, but I've never seen one. Have you?
No, but I don't see a whole lot of the TIAA accounts. So
okay. I've only seen them in 403Bs.
Mm-hmm.
And not in an IRA. Please, listener, just make sure that what you think is a TIA traditional IRA is an IRA and not a 403B. If it's an IRA, you absolutely can continue to offset RMDs on your other IRAs with the excess money you're taking from the TIA. But if that TIA traditional is a 403B, it cannot offset the RMDs of your IRA.
Right.
Okay. Then he asks, to avoid the excess tax burden the trust will experience, My thought is to start taking 10% per year from the TIA traditional through 2026. This will keep me in the 22% tax bracket. So you can see what he's trying to do, Chris.
Right. He's trying to trigger taxes now instead of later.
Right. And he's trying to benefit from the 22 bracket under the Trump tax cuts.
Yep.
Because that 22 goes back to 25. But it goes back to 25, listener, in 2026, not through 2026. So just make sure you understand that. Now, between now and then, they may change the law yet again.
Yep.
Okay. This would keep me within the 22% bracket for the income that I receive. Okay, I'm cutting short a lot of his emails, so that's why you see me pausing. I would like to take all this extra distribution, so all this extra money that he's taken out, Chris, that he doesn't need, and begin funding the Special Needs Trust now and buy municipal tax-free bonds inside it after I pay the taxes owed. So what he's saying is he's going to take that money out of his, what he's calling an IRA, and I hope it is a TIA IRA and not a 403B for his sake because of the way he's trying to do it with his RMDs. He's taking more money than he needs. He's willing to pay taxes on it. Then he wants to take that money, put it in his disabled child's
special needs trust,
and buy municipal bonds with it. He wants to buy munis, and I know why he wants to buy munis. They generate tax-free income. So if the trust holds the muni, the interest is tax-free, and the trust won't owe any taxes.
Right. Yep.
Okay. Then he writes, if you think this would work, I might even increase my IRA withdrawals even higher, as well as from my managed a brokerage account, and also fund the trust now. So he's willing to take even more money and do this. Would this help avoid the large tax liabilities of trusts and the fact that stretch RMDs may go away? Would my plan work if my wife or I died before 2026 and the survivor has to file as a single taxpayer? I would greatly appreciate your views, either directly or during one of your Q&A shows. We're doing it during a Q&A show. There's a lot of moving parts here, Chris, and I'm sure you are picking up on it as well. I have to level with this listener. I don't like his idea. I think there's better options, but I will give him credit for trying to think outside the box and mitigate the tax liability of putting income inside a special needs trust. And for recognizing all money from an always taxable account, even though you see assets, he recognizes it's income. And he's starting to learn when income is received by a trust and held, it is subject to very high trust tax rates. So I'm going to attack first the easy one. Should he move his brokerage money into the trust and then buy munis with it? Absolutely not. Your brokerage account, you can keep your investments, your equities. You're only 74 years old. You could live another 10, 20, 25 years. That can continue to grow. That being your brokerage account, could continue to grow. You could name the brokerage account to pay into the special needs trust at your death or at your wife's death. You could set it up after both of you die. And what is unique, Chris, the special tax treatment that his brokerage accounts would get that would make paying it into a special needs trust no problem?
Well, it's going to get a step up in basis. So all of the embedded gains that are in that account, hopefully if the account's been going up, can escape taxation completely. Right now, if he were to start putting money in there, any of those gains that are inside from here until when he and his wife both pass, you're essentially pushing those gains into the trust itself, where the trust isn't going to die and get the step up. So I agree with you that those doing that now with the brokerage account is not a good idea. The step up in basis isn't an issue with the always taxable accounts because they don't get a step up. So that's a
exactly.
different story.
Now I see what he's trying to do. The Trump tax cuts are in effect. He's trying to take extra money out that he doesn't need from his always taxable accounts. And he's saying, I, the father and mother, we will pay the taxes at 22% and then fund the special needs trust. And he feels that would be cheaper than the risk that the $1 million passes into the special needs trust later and gets subject to the high trust tax rates. And right now, he's willing to put that money in post-distribution. And I hope I explained that right. Probably not. What I'm getting at, folks, he's going to take the money out of the IRA. He's going to pay the taxes on it. So when he puts it into the special needs trust, it's no longer what, Chris?
It's no longer income. Now it's whatever asset that he puts into that. Could be cash, could be something else that he puts in there. But now that you've escaped this always requiring it to be recognized as income issue, because he's pulling that trigger now before it goes into the trust.
Exactly. So he's putting an asset in, so it's not going to be subject to the high trust income tax rates. It'll be received, actually, tax-free by the trust.
Right.
Now, it could be a gift. I'm not well-schooled. This is a Joe question, and she's not here, or an estate planning Pete question. I would assume that is a gift, and if it's greater than $15,000, because there's only one beneficiary of that trust, a gift tax return will have to be filed. It is a gift from him to the trust. But right now, the unified or uniform? I think
unified.
It's unified. Mm-hmm. The unified gift tax credit is $11 million per person. So him and his wife could easily afford, he's only talking about $1 million here, so he's got more than enough gift tax to do it. Just be prepared, a gift tax exemption amount. He may have to file a gift tax return.
Right.
Now, him and his wife could each do a gift, making $30,000 a year going in, and no need for a gift tax return. I'm just saying you might have to file a gift tax return. Yeah. I'm not a complete expert on gift tax returns, but I'm 99% sure a gift tax return may have to be filed in this case.
Yeah, but even if they do, it's not the end of the world.
Right, it's not the end of the world. A lot of people make it sound like the end of the world, but the unified gift tax credit is so high now, just fund this trust for your child. That I understand. I'm still not convinced it's what you should do, listener, but yes, you can do what you're doing. I'm walking you through it. I have no problem with it so far. Well, I do have a problem with it. I think there's a better option, but what you're doing could work. So now you take that, which is now an asset. It's no longer income because you paid the taxes on it. You're putting the asset in. You may or may not file a gift tax return depending on how much is going in. And then you want to buy municipal bonds to reduce the taxes inside the trust. I have no problem with you using munis. You're in the state of Connecticut, high taxes. I have no problem with using munis, but not for everything. That portfolio should be invested, should probably be invested moderately or moderately aggressive. And that's my opinion, but I have not done an investment analysis for you, so maybe it shouldn't. Maybe it should be conservative or conservative growth. What I'm trying to say is once you get an appropriate allocation, once you sit down and have a plan and are convinced this is the level of risk I should have, let's just say it's moderate, maybe the 40% bonds could be munis, but the 60% equities, put it in stocks, but put it in a variable annuity wrapper. Now, I said a four-letter word, or according to Ken Fisher, I'm an idiot for saying that. You should just give Ken Fisher 1.25% of your money, and he'll manage it for you. No, don't give Ken Fisher anything. Put your money in a variable annuity inside that special needs trust. the annuity you should use is a non-commissioned investment-only variable annuity. Nationwide has one, costs $20 a month to maintain. No broker commission. So you need a broker to help you open it. But they don't get paid one red cent unless they want to. The broker should just waive his or her fees. He shouldn't charge you anything to do that. Or just pay for their time. That's how we do it. Pay us for our time, open the account. Or I believe, and I'm not sure, but I believe some of the larger custodians, maybe even Vanguard, but I'm not sure, also offer investment-only variable annuity wrappers. It's not a broker-sold one with the high fees that Ken Fisher, and he's right on this, and I think you'll agree, Chris, broker-sold variable annuities can have very high commissions and fees. We're not disputing that, are we?
No, no. And we're not making a general recommendation promoting variable annuities. It's in this particular case, there's some distinct advantages to putting it in this wrapper.
Right, because putting it in the variable annuity wrapper, investment-only variable annuity, IOVA is the symbol, acronym. No, that would be an initialism, right, Chris? Investment-only variable annuity. We don't say IOVA.
Well, we could.
Yeah, I suppose. But it's actually an initialism, not an acronym. Chris pointed that out to us once. But IOVA, these don't have all the fees and commissions of broker-sold annuities. What they give you, though, is the tax wrapper of the variable annuity. In other words, the assets can grow inside that wrapper. You can rebalance. You can sell and buy different funds inside that wrapper and owe no taxes. And it's going to allow you or your investment advisor to manage the equity portion of your son's special needs trust without what, Chris? The tax liability,
without worrying,
right?
About the tax issues from year to year as you make transactions.
Exactly. Then, when it comes time to selectively transfer money to your son, your trustee will transfer money out of the variable annuity wrapper, out of the trust to your son, and he pays income taxes on it. The downside to variable annuities, all distributions are taxed as income, not capital gain. So that might be a downside to your son, but I doubt it, and here's why. Your son is going to have to stay in a very low income tax bracket anyways, Chris, to qualify for a lot of his government benefits. So even though income is being passed on to the son, I think it's going to get taxed at very low rates.
Yep.
I don't know for sure, but that's what I think. Yeah. Anyways, listener, that just walks through what you want to do. But if it were me, I would first look, whenever a client has excess RMDs, and you do, listener, you said you are willing, in fact, all the money coming from this TIA account, the $250,000, about $24,000, you said, is coming out of that account. You don't need it. You're using it to offset RMDs from your other accounts, which, again, I hope you are doing that right. I hope it's an IRA. But that said, he clearly doesn't need the RMD, Chris. That's the impression I get. Do you agree, or did I misunderstand you?
No, that's what I'm interpreting it the same way.
I always tell listeners, Chris, and I always tell prospects, and I always tell clients, there are four things you can do with excess RMDs. Four things, listeners. You can spend it, and you're not talking about spending it. You want to help your son. But you can spend it. You can save and invest it. You can give it away, which is what you're talking about doing. You're talking about giving it to your son now into his special needs trust. Or you can leverage it. What do I mean by leverage, Chris?
Life insurance.
Exactly. We've talked about this on shows before. I know I've said two four-letter words in this answer. I've said annuity, and I've said life insurance. Actually, Chris said the second four-letter word.
He made
first.
Me say it.
Yes. And the reason I word them that way is so many investment advisors try to talk people out of buying those insurance products because they're more interested in managing your money for 1.25%, 1.5% than doing damn financial planning. But the fact of the matter is, if you and your wife are just reasonably healthy for your ages, you get a survivorship guaranteed universal life policy, SGUL, survivorship guaranteed universal life policy. Stay away from whole life policies, stay away from indexed universal life, stay away from variable universal life. For a variety of reasons I don't want to bore you with, and please, if you're an insurance agent listening to this, I'm not picking on you guys. I just like SGULs better in these cases. I'm not looking to grow cash value. I'm looking to maximize death benefit, and I'm looking for guarantees. I'm not looking for uncertain illustrations that may or may not perform as indicated. I want to fund a special needs trust at the lowest possible cost. I don't need cash value. I want to maximize the inheritance to the child. So, listener, if you qualify, what is so unique, Chris, with second to die? That's what survivorship means. It pays out when the second spouse dies, listener. What is so unique about SGUL policies?
Well, when you look at the benefit that they pay, you get a lot more benefit for the dollar on a second-to-die policy than you do on a single-life policy or two separate single-life policies on each spouse. The second-to-die, due to the actuarial properties of the policy, gives you the best bang for the buck.
Exactly. You might be able to leverage it, listener. All the excess RMD... take it. You're willing to take excess out as it is. So you clearly don't need all that $1 million. So you can take it out or just take the RMD and direct it into a second to die universal life policy, and it might purchase $500,000, $800,000, $1 million, $1.5 million, $2 million of life insurance that would pay into the special needs trust. What is so unique about that much money, Chris, being paid from a life insurance policy into a trust?
Well, one issue is it's all tax-free.
Exactly. Income tax-free. It is 100%
income tax-free. Yep.
Income tax-free. If you look at the tax benefits of that, in other words, how much your trust would have, excuse me, your IRA would have to have earned to pay after paying what could be, as Chris pointed out, 50% taxation to leave $800,000, $1 million, $1.5 million to your special needs child. You might be able to do it by directing $15,000, $20,000 a year into a second to die guaranteed universal life policy. It may work, it may not work. You don't know until you go through underwriting. What you need to do, though, is work with an insurance person. And if you can't find one, I hate talking business. We offer this. So if you can't find someone to help you, get a hold of us. We'll help you. But you can go through what is called pre-underwriting. You're not going to go through underwriting with any insurance company. It's actually wholesale companies that sell insurance, but they employ retired or former, they may not have retired yet, insurance underwriters. And they walk you through the underwriting process as if they were doing their old job. But they're not working through an insurance company anymore. They're doing it on their own. Why are they doing that? They're trying to help you come up with what your rating would be. So once they get an idea of your health, they then go out and shop for the best policy based on the health you and your spouse are at. so you don't have to go through medical underwriting to 20 different insurance companies to get 20 different quotes. You just go through these companies, and they can go out and get 20 offers. They're not a quote. It's just an offer because the insurance company hasn't done their own underwriting yet. So the insurance company says to these companies, hey, if you guys are right, and I've been doing this for years and years with these companies, they're pretty damn good, Chris. Only once did an offer get rejected. And that's because between the time the pre-underwriting was done and the insurance company was chosen, the client suffered a medical condition. So it no longer applied. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
But these companies are so good, listener. That's, to me, what you should do. Oh, and the great thing, listener, they don't charge for it. Why don't they charge for it? They hope you use them to buy the insurance.
Right.
So they can help you shop for the best insurance policy based on your health and your spouse's health. Because if you were to go for quotes, and you want to get a quote from Principal and New York Life and Transamerica, I'm just making these companies up, you got to go through underwriting from every single company, and that's a pain in the hiney. So you use these wholesalers. You should do that. It doesn't cost you anything but time. And that will give you an idea of your health, and you'll start to get offers. Remember, they're not guarantees. They're just an offer. You'll start to get offers coming in that if the underwriters are correct, if the wholesale underwriters are correct, this is what you would pay for insurance. But what those policies will show you is what's called the internal rate of return of the policy. What does that mean, Chris?
Well, it means we need to wrap this call up because I'm 8 minutes late for my appointment.
Yeah, I know. Okay, so
we're getting a little too deep here.
Yeah, well, you know me. But the IRR is what?
It's the internal rate of return, which is the implied rate of return of your, if you consider your premium purchase, what you pay to get into the policy, an investment. They assume certain lifespans before the policy pays out, and they can calculate for you what the rate of return effectively would be if we were treating this as an investment. That's kind of the best way I can think of explaining it.
Exactly. So it's going to tell you what you would have to earn on those premiums to generate the death benefit. And the IRR in year one is astronomical. It's usually 4,000 or 5,000%, obviously. You put in $20,000, they're going to pay $1 million. But as you progress through life, right, the IRR goes down. The IRR will vary based on your health. That's what we want to see, though. When we work with clients doing this, we're looking for that IRR number, and that IRR number will tell us if this is worth doing or not. Now, keep in mind, if your IRR is very low, that means you're not very healthy, and you may pass away early, still making the policy worth it, Chris, because it's tax-free. So we have to take
that into consideration.
No, it's the
opposite, Jim. If the IRR is really high, you're not particularly healthy. You've become not very healthy.
No, if the IRR is high, you're very healthy. Or do I have that fast
action? Well, there's two things. If what they think you are health-wise and then what you turn out to be. It's if you're really healthy, they give you a low premium. If you then die very quickly, the IRR is astronomical. If
true.
They know
yes.
up front that you're not very healthy, then they're going to price it out as such. And the IRR initially goes down if you so it kind of depends on what we're talking about health wise in the health versus in the underwriting phase or health versus after you own the policy when you die.
Correct. Generally speaking, the more unhealthy you are, the lower the IRR because your premiums are that much higher than a healthier person.
Right.
So the IRR is lower. What I'm saying is even if the internal rate of return is low, that generally indicates you're unhealthy, but it still may make sense to buy the life insurance because it still received 100%
right,
tax
the tax rate. Benefits you can't ignore.
Exactly. So what I'm saying, listen, when it comes to special needs trusts, I'm very open-minded and prefer life insurance because it's guaranteed, it's truly simple. especially a guaranteed universal life. It's not hot at all. The GUL, there's no ifs, ands, and buts. Everything is guaranteed. That's why it says GUL. And as long as you pay the premiums, it is guaranteed for the rest of your life. No ifs, no ands, no buts. So I would first, before you start doing what you want to do, I would first look at the life insurance leverage and see if it's there. If it is, that's how I would take care of your special needs child. And if it's not there, then the strategy you have, I think, is okay with the caveats Chris and I put in.
Yep.
Okay,
perfect.
I want to apologize to the two people we didn't get to, but you know Chris, he goes on and on and on, and he's hard to shut up once he gets going. So we will get to those questions another time, correct?
That is for sure.
Okay. Well, listeners, I will not be here next week. Chris will be carrying the ship alone, which means the shows will only be about 20 minutes long, and he'll answer 14 questions.
We have quite a few questions, so, yeah.
Yeah, but you'll get through like 14 in 20 minutes.
Maybe.
So Chris will probably get through every Social Security question that we have, and then I will be back the following week, hopefully with a lot of good information after attending 3 days of advanced estate planning and advanced financial planning topics at the AICPA meeting in Vegas all next week. So Chris is going to explain to you how you can reach us. Then he has to go on a Social Security call with someone. Chris, you have a great week, and I will be in touch with you when I get back.
Okay. Sounds good. Thanks, Jim.
Okay. Bye-bye.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
Investors should consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of investment company products carefully before investing. The prospectus contains this and other information about the investment company. Prospectuses may be obtained from your advisor and should be read in full. All guarantees are backed by the claims-paying ability of the issuing insurer. Withdrawals and death benefits are subject to income tax. If withdrawals and other distributions are received prior to age 59 and a half, a 10% penalty may apply. Shares, when redeemed, may be worth more or less than the original cost.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Securities offered through Cambridge Investment Research Incorporated, a broker-dealer member FINRA SIPC. Advisory services offered through Cambridge Investment Research Advisors Incorporated, a registered investment advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor. Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, and Cambridge are not affiliated.